podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Football-related violence in the UK is escalating, with the police concerned that the English game is in danger of returning to the dark days of the 70s and 80s.
It is the ugly side of the beautiful game. This is what officers face at football matches every week. They've come to watch a game, but are instead intent on making a scene. It is still an hour to kick off outside Wembley, but officers are being tested, as are tempers.
A certain style of life is the simple message written in white that shouts loud from a red banner regularly displayed at Liverpool away matches. And when you think of following a football team in the passionate and some would say obsessive manner that so many of us do, the message is an accurate one. Choosing to follow a football team regularly, especially away from home and into Europe and beyond, is a certain style of life. Early starts, long journeys, financially challenging and not without its sacrifices, both personal and in regards of family and friends. Tight networks of fans, strong bonds, close-knit friends, all can come hand in hand as a result of that life and shared experience, common ground and the love of a football team. But for some, that life can become something more, something darker. Aspects that are really discussed honestly among football fans or in football media. Fashion, music, songs, chants and banners, they're regularly celebrated as being part of football fandom. Excessive use of alcohol, the increased prevalence of cocaine around the game, and the lingering spectre of violence around football matches is much less discussed and often glossed over or ignored. So too are the potential consequences of that behaviour. I'm Gareth Roberts, and alongside Amanda Jacks, a caseworker for the Football Supporters Association, we've spoken to fans up and down the country, some who say they've become addicted to violence, others who've sought help for drug and alcohol abuse. We've spoken to police, an NHS mental health professional, and even a supporter who walked away from the game after decades of hardly missing a match, home, away, or abroad. This is about football and life balance, about pride and passion leading to paths less trodden, and about honest conversations with those who've walked those paths and are still walking them now. Can football fandom sometimes go too far? Can it be bad for your health, physically and mentally? And ultimately, can you pay a price for what we all call passion? We ask these questions and more in this Anfield Wrap special.
Creates conflict. It creates toxicity. It creates arguments. You know, and next thing you know, these two stags are butting each other senseless. And to see who comes out on top, it's exactly the same. You know, and that's the animal world, unfortunately. This is what we're dealing with. You know, it all triggers back to the same sort of stuff, and it's wrong. It's just not healthy.
There's no feeling like it. The adrenaline rush is better than any drug I've ever taken in my life.
They come together over weekends, and it's that collective experience of being part of something. You know, and you can easily be drawn into getting involved in other things. Then, as you say, drug use. You know, or, you know, just have a go. It's everyone else is on it.
I've always got stuck in. I've always one of the first to get smacked. I've always said that I'm not the hardest, but I do love getting punched.
It was grim. It was grim to watch that. At the same time, I'll be absolutely honest, and the absolute chaos and anarchy of it, appealing, but in the wrong way. Like, the feeling of freedom was pretty up there, really. No one can tell you what to do when you've got 500, 600, 700 people.
That's why I call it the circle, because as soon as you get in it, it's addiction. It's addicted. And the feeling with your mates, just being around a group of you and thinking that we're unbeatable here. We could take anyone on. It's that feeling where you look at it and you think, yeah, nothing will ever come close to feeling that again, but how much shit issues it brought on my life.
We'll start with Gary, a lifelong Liverpool fan. Gary's story starts much the same as many football fans, going the match first of all with his dad and then later with mates as a teenager. At first, it was all about the football, playing it and watching it, supporting the Reds. But soon, it became something more.
Then I said that regularly started going with my mates, and then you start meeting up with different lads from all over different areas of Liverpool. And then from around about age, I say 14, 15 there, that group of us who we met from different cultures built our own little culture, our own little, as we call it, yeah, the firm at the time. It would just go, we'd just go to the games there and back. But then I started to notice that a change in the behaviours from us, from different other Liverpool fans, you know what I mean? On our coach, there wouldn't be no club colours, no identity of Liverpool FC at all. I wouldn't say, but also when it's just scouts, it's not, because I've had lads in our firm there who are from, like, you know, like we've gone from Chorley, to like the different parts who have come, you know what I mean? But they're all what I've classed as, I've made real mates at the match than I have grown up. That's been more important to me. I've had lads who you really find out who your mates are. So yeah, from about 14, 15 then, I started noticing the football hooliganism and the drug culture and, you know, the clobber as well. So it turned into a very expensive, it was my life, it turned into my life. Football was my life, you know what I mean? I was working just to go to football, all my money spent on that, to buy new clothes, I had to have a new jacket for the next away game, or, you know, it was just something like that. And then it turned in from just normal lads going to the game to
become, back of the bus lads.
Yeah, to back of the bus lads, yeah. I gradually worked my way back up, and I was sitting at the back of the bus. You don't think at the time, but now thinking of it today, I was at the back of the bus, and then, like, obviously the internet nowadays, it's easy to get out the numbers. I was looking up to the older lads, you know, seeing we had an older firm called, obviously, the Urchins. And then we were classed ourselves as the young Urchins, then Liverpool Youth. We got good numbers guaranteed away, you know, 30, 40 of us on that coach. Not saying every single one of them would stand the back, some of them would just be there for the look, you know what I mean, to act like that, but at least 20 of the lads there I've met with, would, you know, anybody, they'd all stand and no one'd run, it'd all be, you'd find out who your real mates are there. And then, you know, this would be home and away, abroad, everywhere we'd go, we'd all stick together, and home games, we'd notice we'd all meet 2 hours before, something like that, at the Sand and Wall at the time. And then I'd organise it, I'd have the other contacts for other youth firms, and I'd organise this. This would be, you know, for the week building up to the game, I'd be organising it myself, you know, on the phone, ringing the other, say it was playing United or Chelsea, whatever, I'd be on contact, organising it straight away, and I'd love it. It was my life, and I'd get a buzz out of it. I got caught in, I think I was 14 when I first got, I got arrested for Wrexham away. That was my first one, and I got put on a, you know, tag for that.
Pre-season friendly.
Pre-season friendly was, yeah. Fucking fighting on the terrain with them there, yeah. Yes, that was only pre-season friendly, but it didn't stop me. It just made me want to do more because I felt big.
Things were starting to escalate for Gary. He was known by police. He had a name and a reputation. And violence was a regular thing, almost a way of life. And unbeknown to him, he was being watched.
The worst one was in 2014. When we got done for football violence then, and when we got pulled in for it, it weren't just for that one event. It kicked off in town against a team in town in the Irish American Bar, which is a regular bar we used to all go back to home and away games, and it kicked off in there, and then a few months later our doors went in and we got arrested for that event. But then as you got taken in, there was a list of the police liaison officer had on us every single games, and you know, everyone we'd had. So obviously they'd been keeping track on us, and straight away before it's like we would, like you said, then got offered not help. I'm not saying help because obviously we know what we're doing, but what we got prison sentence straight away and banned from watching Liverpool for 9 years. So straight away my life just got taken off me.
So what age was that when that happened then?
Well, that was 2014, so I think I would have been, I think, something like 19, so like that, I think it was, yeah.
So what was the build-up to that? Because, you know, you obviously talked about how, you know, you're going with your dad, then you started going on your own, but when did you first ever see something or get involved in something and almost get a taste for us, I think? Because when me and you have spoke, you know, off mic, you talked about how you got, like, an adrenaline buzz, yeah, and then wanted more of it. So when was the first time you experienced that buzz, if you like?
Yeah, my first one would have been West Brom, actually, away. I don't know if that's your date, but yeah, we went off the coach, and that was the first. They organised it before, but they never actually could. You know, sometimes they say the police wouldn't let us get to us, or there's always a reason why, you know, we'd always be let down, so it was always over the phone, so it never really happened. West Brom away, yeah, we were on the train, and we stayed behind a bit longer, our lads. We said we'd leave this time, let a bit clear out, and that. So we stayed behind the ground, we were walking down, and they said they were coming up, and he was. We actually met on the fucking middle of a roundabout. On the main road there, like, it was on the middle of the man, what they seen them, it was about 15, 20 of them, and that's the first time, like, there's no feeling like it. The adrenaline rush is better than any drug I've ever taken in my life. It's like, as soon as you see the other firm there, and you're with your good lads, you look left, right, and behind you, and you know them good lads are there, and it's just literally going into, you know, it is like going to battle, you know.
Gary told us about earning respect and what he called credit from opposition fans for how he and his firm were handling themselves. They saw it as fighting for Liverpool, fighting for the club, creating and maintaining a reputation. But such was the love for the fight now, what brought them to this way of life, the actual football, was becoming almost irrelevant.
I used to go watch the match and like going to the match, but when it became into the firm, the 90 minutes was the part I hated. You know, going to the match, watching the match, I wouldn't do it. All I think about was the fight. You know, the buzz of that was my adrenaline. So I'd go to, like, Cardiff away, and we were going to Cardiff away, and it was, like, about 20 of us sat on the coach while the match was going on, because we weren't there for the match. We were there to the fight. You know, they were all taking the drugs on there like they do, and, you know, we're talking about what we're going to do after we were organising it. The 90 minutes was the worst part of the journey for me, which that's when I realised, become bad. This is actually a bit of a problem for me, this now. You know, I'm not afraid to admit, so I'm suffering now with drug addiction now myself, and I'm putting the blame onto that because I got banned from the match.
I was going to ask you about that, you know, yeah, the sort of associated lifestyle. So you talked about before, about when you first started going on coaches, you were at the front and you're a bit green, not knowing what's going on at the back, but you work it out. You end up working your way back there and becoming part of that yourself. What about that associated lifestyle? Like, when did the drug side of things get a little bit out of control for you?
The truth is, like, when you used to go at the front, I wouldn't drink when he was in Kale. Yeah. I think me never drank because I was playing footy at that time as well. So I just always remember having Lucozade or my Red Bulls and that. And when you go up, when sitting at the front of the coaching young lad, you go into the back, you notice it. But I was a bit oblivious because I was that young, I went too much into it. But, like, the more you grow up, you see it, don't you? Drugs for me, wasn't for me at the match. My drug for me was the football violence. I started taking drugs when I got banned from the match. All right. My mates was, they'd take cocaine and obviously they'd all be bladdered and that. But my drug was me, I'd be on my phone organising with the other firm. And that's what I'm saying. Now I've come into, when I got banned for the 9 years, my life lost. It's come to a standstill of thinking, I've got nothing, I can't go and watch Liverpool anymore. That's how much my life depended on it.
Ultimately, things caught up with Gary. He found himself arrested and on the front page of the local newspaper. He remembers his mum being in tears, and he discovered what he regarded as not a big deal or just having a fight at the match was not seen in the same way by the authorities.
I didn't think I was getting sent down. We turned up at the Crown Court and my brief said to me, "Have you got your bag?" I said, "What do you mean, have you got my bag?" And then my mum was there, my dad said, "Did you come down?" He said, "Yeah, more than likely be coming down here." I said, fucking hell, lad, you haven't been telling me that. I've been going to meetings with him, you know, building up to it. And he said, this, you know, this is looking, not looking good for you. He said, go and have your dinner. And a few of the lads. And so we obviously went and had the dinner, come back in. I think I had the youngest lad with us there. It was about 13, 14, one of our young lads. I was 12, 14, he might get off with it, you know what I mean? I was me and this lad, who's one older lad than me there. So I thought if anyone was going, it's definitely me and him. But he just had all his custodial sentence. We just thought, fucking hell. But then, even that though, then, it looked at me, I remember looking at me, my mum just burst into tears. And she said, look after yourself, lad, be safe. And because I think she thought I would have fucking done myself in also, you know what I mean? Because it was just a big shock to everyone. A few of the lads turned up without their beds or out the family. They thought it was just going to be Gwen, he's getting, I don't know.
Suspenders,
yeah, right. That's what we were hoping for, a little ban or something like that. You know what I mean? We thought, well, I'll go out and have a drink after this, but fucking have we got slammed? And but then when we went down, I remember us all just having a little laugh in the holding cell underneath the thing, you know, went to be put in the prison van. And then we were singing Liverpool songs in the back of the fucking sweatbox going there. And away and until the next morning, me and my mate Patrick got raided straight away. And that's when I thought, fucking hell, we're in here, this is it. And it was 2 days before Christmas when we got sentenced. So it was just all at once. But I said, even there was tough times in there. I must say it was hard. There was times when my mates would have a visit and I wouldn't have a visit. And I'm thinking, wow, this is not what I want to be doing this. But to come back out, I'm straight back into it again. So just going to prison's not the answer for if that's what they expect. Anyway,
how long did you serve?
We got 9 months. I got out 3.5 months, but then done the rest on tag.
Bringing it back to now in 2022. Gary is still trying to find the right path.
I can't see a way out of it. That is my culture, football culture. My thing with Liverpool is the football fans, the dress scene. You know, it's...
So when you've come back, have you just picked up where you left off with the same lads, basically, and gone back to that same scene, exactly. Basically? Yeah.
Some of them have obviously learned the lesson from prison, but I haven't. I'd say half as haven't, to be honest with you. And there's new lads now coming through. You know, there's still people there who I used to go with. I did... Want to, in my head, I wanted to force them, this is enough now, you know, we got to grow up and that. But as soon as I'm back around there, the atmosphere, the buzz, you know, the smell of the ale, I said, now I'm on drugs myself and I'm trying to get out with now seeing it, and it's just doubled up the buzz. And I'm thinking, wow, but there's no better feeling for it. I don't know what it would take me to stop.
What about some of the older men that you mentioned before, yeah, who, you know, you have perhaps walked this same route and then changed direction? If you like, do any of them try and sort of self-police, try and talk you out of it, try and say, you know, you need to calm down or you need to knock this on the head? Do you get any of that from any of them?
Yeah, I do. I couldn't ask for any more. I've had a lot of advice from older lads who've been down there and says it doesn't end well. You end up back in prison, you know, could even end up dead. No, that's how serious it is, isn't it? But I agree with them. So I'll be standing in the pub and I'll say, yeah, you're right in that. But as soon as I'm out there and you see all the lads, the firm getting together and that, and they're walking together, and there's no way I'm standing there while all the lads are walking to have a meet. You know, because I wouldn't live for myself if I, you know, went that, found out, like, you know, if they've been smashed by another firm and I haven't been there. It's also like a bit of... You get called like a shit house, or in the firm you get called a runner, or, you know, if you go to a meeting, you're fucking running away while the other firm are coming. You looked at like a proper lower life, you know what I mean? There's no respect for you then ever, you know what I mean? So you don't want that. I've been beat up loads of times over, you know, I've had a few hidings because you've been outnumbered, but at least they haven't ran away. You know, I've stood there with the lads, and even though I know it's the wrong idea, maybe it's just for the pride, for trying to get... Not trying to get a name for myself at the match, but you grow up and you read books of like the football hooligans and you see like, wow, then these films and stuff like that, you know what I mean? So they're the things what just show you what you're meant to do, but in real life, if you're clever, you really shouldn't be doing that. You know what I mean? If you want a life, there's a life bit as well as the match.
A life as well as the match, Gary said there, and perhaps that's the key. Graham, a Lincoln City fan, is training to be a counsellor, but he was sucked into a world of regular football violence, fuelled by drug taking and alcohol binges, and he too found himself arrested with a criminal record against his name and with a banning order from his club. Now he's desperate to shake the label of being a football hooligan, and he's trying his best to make a new life for himself, but he admits it's not easy.
And so what about, you know, you mentioned earlier on that, you know, you're now training to be a counsellor. You obviously, you know, you want to go down a different path of your life. How hard is it to walk away from something you've known so well for so long and these tight bonds that you've got with people who are getting involved in that? Is it difficult for you to sort of get away from your former life around football?
I think there's aspects of it. I'm still close with quite a few of them. And they're still my mates. I've gone through thick and thin with them. Like I still have a lot of love for them. But it's aspects of, and what I've learnt and what I said in my banning interview with the football club is that I'm putting in blockers to stop me from getting involved in that. And I think that's one of the things is that I think we spoke on the phone and said that it's like a drug, football violence, and you can't, once you've sampled it, once you've had that rush and adrenaline, that never leaves you. You can't forget that feeling. But the thing that you can do, and if you treat it like you would a drug addict or whatever, you wean off it. You're putting blockers to say that I'm going to keep control of. I think it's more of a confidence thing, and I think it depends who I'm with. I think with my group, I'll be open about what I want to do, and I'll say that. In terms of influencing people, I think it's more just creating that awareness of is it the right thing to do? But ultimately, that's their decision, and I respect them for it. They're still my mates. Nothing will ever change that. But when you kind of force something on someone or try push too hard, they snap back and they put another defence up. They almost cut you out, and then that way, you're never going to get through to them.
I mean, how hard is it with the sort of the male network aspect of it as well? I mean, you know, you mentioned at the very start of the chat about sort of a scrap when you, whatever it was, 14, 15, 16, and about instantly getting some respect around that. It must be hard to be, you know, going seeing those same faces and now be saying, nah, I'm coming out of it now. Because, you know, aren't they going to be like, you know, I'm thinking about what it's like in a male network with pints in your hand, with people who've done lines in a pub Saturday, all of that. You know, is it not like, well, Graham's gone softer?
Yeah, I think so. I think that the thing is that helps me as well is because I've always got stuck in. I've always one of the first to get smacked. I've always say that I'm not the hardest, but I do love getting punched. So it's one of those things. Maybe I need to take up boxing or something. But yeah, no, I think it's kind of, it's eased by the fact that I've done it. I'm not one of these people that sat at the back of a fight that's going on. They know that I'm not soft kind of thing. So it helps in that respect. But yeah, there's been games that they've asked me to come out to and I've been like, no, I really can't. I know it's going to kick off. I know that it's just the police cell waiting to happen.
At this point in the podcast, we wanted to bring you another football fan, a young Birmingham City supporter who, just like Graham and Gary before him, spoke of the strong bonds formed with friends through football. He travelled home and away watching his team, and he spoke of those friends as being more important to him than his own family. He explained too that it's often difficult to get across to people who don't follow football in the same way what it all means. On a Monday, he said, the first thing he's looking forward to there is that first can on the train on Saturday, travelling to an away game. It's what he works for, he said, and it's what he lives for, he said. In respect of the violence, he used that word once again, addicted. And he told the people he knew who'd completed prison sentences and banning orders and immediately returned to the same way of life. He spoke of pride, of status, of defending a name and a reputation around the football club and how powerful all of that is. On his request, following a recent situation with police, we have not used his interview. A fan we're calling James for this podcast, a supporter of a club in the Northwest, has experienced multiple arrests, time in cells, and has been issued with a banning order. He too told us of a feeling that fueled his behaviour, but also admitted he wouldn't want his son following in his footsteps.
That's why I call it the circle, because as soon as you get in it, it's addiction. It's addicted. And the feelings with your mates, just being around a group of you and thinking that we're unbeatable here. We can take anyone on. It's that feeling where you look at it and you think, yeah, nothing will ever come close to feeling that again. But how much shit issues it brought on my life.
So, I mean, I know it's very difficult to look into the future, but hypothetically, if you ever have a son, how would you bring him up?
He'd be a rugby fan.
Would he?
No, I'd take him the games and that. I'd take him the matches, but I wouldn't let him go down the route of what I've done. I wouldn't want the heartache being brought to me, what I brought to my family, of watching your son stand in court and a Crown Court and facing time inside and stuff like that. It's looks like looking back when I was in court, to look back at my mum, she was in tears when I was in the dock, and that's an eye-opener to see your mum crying and realising what trouble you're in.
Seeing his mother in tears in the courtroom wasn't the only time James's choices led to unenviable moments with his family.
I'd been away with family on day trips and been arrested in the train station for travelling and breach of banning order. I was arrested for breach of banning order in front of my mum, my nan, my granddad and everyone. Where my team were playing was in Lancashire, and I was actually in Manchester. And because I had used the public transport on that day, it was classed as a breach of banning order because I was travelling up north. So I got seen on the train platform coming off to go around shopping with my family, and I was arrested and charged with breach of banning order and end up in the Crown Court.
And they were just not interested in the story you're telling us now about being with your family, about going shopping.
No, they saw it as, because the group of my friends travelled to that day and they must have used the same route as I used. They saw me as potentially getting on a later train to meet them up there. And I tried and pleaded and no, nothing. Even my family members were pleading to say, we got return tickets to here. And
I imagine that obviously didn't go down well with your family as well.
No, it didn't, when they had to come pick me up from Manchester Sales the following day.
For Mickey, not his real name, a supporter of a London club, the threat of arrest, court, banning orders, and the advent of increased CCTV and camera phones means many are turned away from violence, only to attach other addictive behaviours to their time around football.
I can definitely see the attraction, but ultimately because that culture is nihilistic. You know, that culture is derived from violence on the terraces. With the advent of football banning orders, CCTV, and even more recently, camera phones, to go out and do that, you would have to be absolutely militant not to end up in front of a court. And that's the other side would have to be that militant, and that doesn't exist. So if your own sloppiness doesn't get you, their sloppiness will. That has a very short shelf life, being real. And you're going to have to deal with the consequences of the courts and stuff like that. Now, some people are willing to do that, fine, but the vast majority ain't. That's why you get this situation where you always see these videos of two groups of lads wanting the other one to throw the first punch so they can claim self-defence. I mean, fuck me, like, just give it up, innit? Like, what's the point? Like, that culture, the casual subcultures, for me, all the other bits of trimmings, the clothes, the music, all that stuff, comes from... the act of tribalism and dominating another part of the country, another part of the city or stuff like that. So it's such a short shelf life, to be honest with you. Like, you're going to get caught yourself, or the other side are going to catch, or you're just going to get unlucky. And to be honest with you, it ain't got much stick to it. And so they push further into the other little annals of it, which is the booze, the coke. That's a big change. When I first started going, not as much gear knocking about. There weren't. For instance, if I think, I remember getting on a coach way back when, first few ones, honestly, it'd be like a couple people would have it. A couple people. Sometimes they'd split it with people. Now, if you were to go football and get on a coach, you're in a minority if you're not sniffing. It's just the thing's gone hand in hand. And like, yeah, I think that there's a very strong, I see other groups of lads, not with mine, because the group tries very hard to make sure people don't go down those paths, and that doesn't always work.
Self-policing.
Has to be.
Yeah.
If they're your mates, you need to be having a fucking word sometimes, saying that is not okay. Even in our world, football world, which is hedonistic, you know, for sure, definitely. You've got to be able to say that, like, put hand on someone's shoulder and say, oh, you need to be, this can't be going on like that. I see others, I mean, there's gambling as well, that sort of like betting, online betting culture as well. Like, when they're sort of like joking about betting on some like Ugandan under 17 team, and it's like, I mean, it's kind of funny for about 5 seconds, and then you're like, well, actually, you're just addicted to that. Or like, the coke, yeah, the booze and stuff. I see a lot of like older geezers going football who've just been absolutely fucked by the booze and the drugs. Some of them have got sober, and more power to them, really changed their lives, a lot of respect for those guys. But some of them ain't, and you're just like, you are hanging on by a shoestring there, my son, aren't you? You don't look at them and respect them, and that's a majority. That's a majority. So yeah, just like booze, coke, chatting shit, nothing solid behind it. Just it's consuming. It's, you're not becoming anything. You're acting on a whim that's out of your control. So,
and so, you know, you're of a certain age got mentioned before. Would you make a conscious effort as someone who's got respect in your group to maybe say to some of the younger lads, listen, you don't want to go down that road?
Yeah, it's a constant thing that. It's going to happen all the time, you know, and that might be motivated by circumstances in their life, but yeah, I've had a lot of conversations, sat down with people, I've taken time out because I see the importance of it, because it can be so destructive, between the booze and the gear, that it really fuck your life up big time. What's quite worrying is just, yeah, younger ones, they're just on it. It's just so normal. Whereas I feel like we always say that the lads that I specifically went with, sort of like 29, 30, we learned to drink before anything else. Those ones now, any younger than that, they only, the two go hand in hand, the booze and the coke, they can't differentiate between the two. And that's really dangerous because like, you have a couple of pints, two pints, and then they're on the phone to call something in. And it's like, that ain't good. That's some heavy shit. Like, booze is strong stuff. At the end of the day, it's very culturally normal in this country to get fucked up from a young age and to an old age as well. It's culturally very acceptable. So if you associate something that's going to be every wedding, every funeral, every Friday after work, every football game, every rave, every time you go out for a drink with your missus with a packet, that is a very dangerous game of association. So yeah, the availability of gear in the last just over 10 years is mad.
So what about a police perspective? PC Paul Elliott is a football officer in Lancashire. He often travels to away games with supporters and believes there's a growing issue with cocaine, particularly among younger fans.
I think at the minute, one of the growing issues, and it's almost anecdotal really, because we are seeing a massive sort of increase in drug use, I would say. But I think societally we are as well, aren't we? You know, I don't think it's just a football thing. I think young lads doing cocaine is an issue, but it's an issue on a Thursday night. It's an issue on a, you know, it's not just a football thing. It's a thing. However, if you're going to a football match in London per se, and you're jumping on a train at 7 a.m. with 10 cases of, you know, whatever, 10 cans of lager and a couple of, you know, bags of coke, you're putting yourself at massive risk. For me, you know, it's a long day.
Yeah.
And, you know, them 10 cans will be done by the time they get off the other end at Euston, and then it's into a pub in Euston, and it is an issue. Now, you know, when people are arrested, they're not drugs tested, so you can't really put figures on it. However, there is an increase in arrests of people in possession of drugs at football. And I think if there was more, you know, arrests made, you know, if there was more scrutiny placed on it, you would probably find that you could double, treble that. You know, every week, every away game, I'm going to there's at least one or two complaints about drug use, either in the ground or at a pub. You know, I was at Hull recently with Preston fans, and there was a report of, you know, from a licensee about people using drugs in a pub. Now, we've only got limited resources, and I don't want to sort of cry on about resources, because for me, you know, as a taxpayer, I want my police officers to be solving crimes in and around where I live. You know, I want them to be dealing with the burglar. You know, like, that's the common thing you get shouted at. Yeah, you know, go and arrest a burglar or a paedophile, whatever, you know. That's a common theme within football policing. Haven't you got nothing better to do? And you know what? We have got a lot better things to do. But at the minute, you know, young lads are going to football matches, drinking too much, taking a load of cocaine, and it's leading to issues that we then have to pick up and deal with. Now, we've had 2 years away from football. You know, football fans haven't been in grounds for 2 years, and we've seen a massive sort of spike and surge in behaviour akin to what we saw at Wembley during the Euros. And the age range of people who are getting involved in this is frightening, really. That's, I think that's the most startling thing, is the age of the people involved in it. Now, I don't know whether looking back, you know, when I was that age going to football matches, 15, 16, going to away games and all that, well, there certainly wasn't any, you know, class A drug usage. It wasn't a thing in the 80s, really, unless it, you know, went on behind my back, and that's not me saying it because of the job I do. That just wasn't a thing then. There was, you know,
it was ease, wasn't it? And the night,
yeah, but even that was like the 90s, wasn't it, really? It wasn't really, it was like late, really late 80s into the early 90s, that it was, you know, ecstasy and LSD and going to raves and stuff. It didn't really overspill into football, I don't think. Certainly not from my experience of it anyway. But nowadays, the age of these lads going to football matches and doing drugs, it is frightening. I think they leave themselves in a really vulnerable position from a health point of view, you know, because if you're out of it, down in London, who's looking after you?
Yeah.
But also, you know, if you end up getting nicked, you know, you just narrow your chances in progressing in life, don't you? You know, I do a lot of work with the Preston North End Community Trust, and I go in and speak to some of the students they have a sixth form, and I go in not from a football point of view, I go in from a sort of a life choices point of view, in that the decisions you make now are the decisions, you know, that you could regret when you're 10, 15 years down the line, and they come back to bite you when you're putting that application in for a job, or you're trying to go to America on holiday, and you realise that actually you have to, you know, put down that you've been convicted of an affray or whatever, and the Americans aren't going to let you in. But trying to get that across to 16, 17-year-olds who were in a group of 30, bouncing around the concourse, throwing ale everywhere.
Paul also acknowledges the power of groups, and even told us of an incident when a supporter was grateful to be banned as it offered a way out.
You know, what I see in the eyes of some lads is they're quite pleased that the police have stood in between them, because they don't want to be there. But how do you break that cycle? How do you get them from not being there when they're part of it? That's the challenge, isn't it?
I think that's what I was trying to talk about, is this like fringe of toxic culture, and how do you challenge it all round, really? I mean, because, you know, if there's someone who lads look up to or whatever, like he wears all the right clobber, he's been to every away game for 20 years, and he's doing something, then it's like, oh, well, whoever, Mick, Tony, whoever it is doing it. We want to do it, and we want to be part of that gang. And it's that sort of legacy of bellendry that gets passed down. That you know, I think we all want to challenge that, because, you know, I just want to be able to go to a ways myself or abroad or whatever and not be treated in a certain way. You know, there's loads of Reds who were pissed off that they had to go and queue for tickets in Milan and it took ages and all that.
Yeah,
they wanted to look around Milan. Do you know what I mean? It should be like, you know, go and taste the food, look at the buildings, all of that kind of gear. But instead they stood in this queue to be given a QR code at the end of it to go to the game.
Yeah. It takes a really strong character, doesn't it, to try and break away from any of that type of thing. You know, it's the same with gangs. You know, once you're sort of in it, it's how do you get out of it, if you want to get out of it. You know, I've had people say to me, I'm glad you banned me, like, because it was a way out. And so, you know, and some people will look to get banned for that reason. It's an excuse then. And well, I, you know, I don't have to go. I don't have to be part of this anymore. Didn't want to be a part of it to start with, but went along with me mate Yasun in the group, and everything's great about it. You know, the bit, the going with your mates to new places, new pubs, new faces, new, you know, having a day out until the fists start flying, and then I don't want to be part of that. However, I look like a right shit house if I don't get involved, you know, and it takes a real strong character to try and get away from that. Mm. I don't know how we broach that. I don't know how we break that.
I just wanted to sort of revisit the bit where you were saying about, because I think it's probably the bit that jumped out at me most. People are literally saying, I'm glad you're banning me, because
yeah.
I want out, but this is the only way I can think to get out. You know, what do you remember about those conversations?
Again, it was a lad who sort of used to take a back seat anyway, and he wasn't particularly interested in the football. I think it was that wanting to belong to something, and, you know, he was there more for the day out. The football was a bit of a distraction from it, and the fighting was even less of it, you know, less of appealing to him. And he ultimately got banned, and I bumped into him a few years later and said, you know, I haven't seen you for, you know, what have you been, how are you, how are you doing and all that. And he just said, you know, I'm so pleased you got, I got banned. He said, you know, because although he was really close to his that circle of friends, he wasn't into the scuffling, you know, the fighting side of it. Now again, I think it's changed. I think the environment's changed, and I certainly don't see that sort of old school risk hooligan group like, you know, the traditional old days. And I think that's because of changes in sort of society, and also the increase in technology, cameras, all this sort of stuff. What you're seeing now, you see people going to prison a lot more for football related, you know, if they're involved in a violent disorder. I know there was a recent case with Newcastle and Burnley fans, and they got sent to prison, you know, and you know, if, as Amanda said, you know, it's highlighted a lot more than, a lot more is made of incidents at football, for what, you know, we could argue over the reason and why, but it's a fact that happens. If you're involved in a violent disorder at a football match and you get caught, the likelihood is you probably will go to prison. So a lot of these older lads, a lot of these older firms are, I think they understand that, they see that, and they've sort of gone back to being more observant, still you know, doing what they do on a match day, still being part of the experience, but they're not crossing that line into, you know, unless, and again, you know, this is the thing I see all the time, you know, they won't take a step back, you know, if it drops on the toes, they won't take a step back, but they'll, you know, and they'll stand the ground. But I don't think in general people are going looking for fights these days. The issue comes in that the behaviour, this sort of increase in antisocial behaviour, the drugs use, the alcohol, invariably leads to confrontation.
Mm.
And that's where the, you know, that's where the issue lies. And if you're in that circle of friends and you're tight, you know, and you but you're not a fighter and you don't really want to get involved, how do you get away from that? How do we help? What can we do to help? What can key stakeholders do to try and solve that problem? I haven't got the answer to that, to be honest with you.
What we've heard so far leads to a number of questions. One being, how can you walk away from something you have loved for so long? If football or a group of mates around football have been so central for so long to how you've lived your life, how do you change behaviour that is so deeply ingrained? Long-term listeners to the Anfield Wrap will remember Steve Armstrong contributing to shows. Steve, he followed Manchester United home and away for 4 decades, and he was also a contributor to and a seller of United We Stand fanzine. After giving it all up, he now describes himself as peacefully in another place.
I became acutely aware of what football took from me. Now, I don't blame football or the environment. You know, the other day, we're all big boys who can make decisions about what we do and how we do it. But, you know, I often point back to that sort of 2016 year in my life where, you know, my dog died in February, which broke my heart. My auntie died in June, who I loved. My gran died in September. And then my mum died at the age of 66 in November. And I'm sitting there holding my mum's hand as she's passing and thinking about all the times where she'd invited me around for tea. And I'd like, can't, I've got Norwich at home. And you're sitting there thinking, you know, so you have these kind of moments in your life where those things certainly come across. You know, you do make sacrifices in this pursuit of wanting to be part of something, or that fear of missing out on something. Nobody wants to be sat at home when you know your mates are having a massive laugh in an away end, having just, you know, scored in the last minute against City or whatever. So all of these things do mount up on you.
But how did you get the light bulb, though? Because I think you touched on something before about that. You know, so yeah, you might have acted or not when City won the league or whatever, but I bet you if you spoke to your peers at the time and explained what you'd done or how you were or whatever, they were just like, yeah, sound, I was like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so then, you know, it's backed up, isn't it? And it's like, it's a cultural thing that you're locked into. And you're like, oh yeah, I was fuming for days about, you know, conceding this goal to Everton or whatever it might be. And then, you know, how did you get, how did you come away from it, look down on it and go, I don't want that anymore?
It wasn't like one big thing. It was the sum of a number of parts. You know, I talked about, I didn't like the way I was after that game. I crossed the line, probably the only time I have, where I took that, you know, as a package of things, you know. I crossed the line, both in all, you know, I was a knobhead at work, I was a knobhead at the match, and I was an arsehole at home. So I crossed the line in all areas, right? So that was there. Again, the 2016 thing, and I suddenly started to think, you know, I'm giving too much time to football and not enough time to perhaps things that should be more important to me. So there was that element. So the accumulate, and then, you know, you took in all these other things, like, you know, all of the things I've mentioned about how you're treated and the environment that's created, et cetera, et cetera. It wasn't a difficult thing to decide to do. But then doing it is the difficult part. And you just weigh up, you know, can I do without this? And it wasn't.
Have you not had, you know, FOMO since, if you like? Have you not had, like, almost like a grief for what's gone?
To be honest, United have made it very easy not to have that. But the only opportunity, because this is the other interesting thing, I haven't, but I was very lucky with this, I think, because I went to PSG away in 2019, it would have been, in the March. And obviously I'd stopped going the aways previous Christmas. And even there, I was like, I don't want to be here. It's not a good trip. And obviously it ended up being, you know, two down from the first leg, ended up winning 3-2 or something. It was an amazing experience. But I was hollow inside. You know, I was like, I should be bouncing it, and I wasn't. So I knew I'd turned something off. But then the big one was Crawler, who's a good pal of mine, was fighting in LA in the next round. So when everybody was in Barcelona for the next round, and I knew that was always going to be my first test, and I wasn't asked. Now, it helped being in LA watching something like that, but I wasn't in the slightest bit bothered that wasn't in Barcelona. And I knew then that I could do it. What a lot of people fear is their thinking of whether they can't do it or not. And as a result of that, they don't put themselves into an environment to see whether they can or not. Whereas I did. And it's unbelievably easy. But the important thing, though, is at the end of the day, football is still a buzz and a thrill and an important thing, you know, to go and switch off something to. And it's about filling your time up with other things. As I said, I always loved me racing, so I knew, can I plug some time? That where ordinarily I'd be at a match, I'll go to a race meeting. I've started going to watch rugby league a lot, and that's been a real eye opener to me. You know, fantastic sport, great rivalry, good buzz of the match, but without any of the bollocks. No, none of the hatred, although there's certainly rivalries, but you don't fear it. You know, you're not walking around thinking, am I going to get stabbed here? Or am I, you know, there's none of that. There's no over policing. You know, there's no, you can't have a drink, even though you're a 50-year-old man, you can't have a drink. None of that. And it's just a better environment. I've had none of that. And look, United won a European final last year. Didn't bother me one bit. I didn't find it hard at all. So, it wasn't. Because listen, for everything I might fear I've missed out on, I'm happier, I'm healthier, I'm fitter. I'm absolutely the most peaceful I've ever been in my life. And I feel great for it.
Mickey, too, has changed his life. He still follows his football team, but his lifestyle is very different now.
The best thing you can do is set an example. Don't speak, set an example. So people always respect someone who you can, if you can talk the talk, great. But if you ain't walking the walk, you're not failing in your aims, you're damaging them. So for me personally, I don't drink, I don't take drugs, try and work out, box most days. People will respect an example a lot more than they're going to respect empty words, sort of thing. I've been there, done it, seen it, turned around and saw that it was nihilistic. And fundamentally, it's just covering up other things that are problems. You're, instead of confronting problems, you're trying to escape from them. And obviously, if you genuinely can go football and you ain't financially fucking yourself up, and you can have a couple of beers and a line and you really enjoy yourself, that's brilliant. But I really feel that there's a large percentage that can't control that. I really strongly feel that. And I don't, this is, when you don't drink or don't do drugs anymore, especially in this culture, this world, you really don't want to become preachy. And I'm always very sure to check myself before I speak about these things, because you don't want to be the guy like, oh, he couldn't knack it, sort of thing, because otherwise they're going to dismiss your argument immediately. But at the same time, it is a lot. You get older, you get more responsibilities, not even like 30, like 25, so you've got to hold down a job, you've got to pay the rent and all that, and to do those things after really caning it on the weekend a lot, I think people do naturally grow out of it. But the more it happens, the more people involved to that intensity, is you're not going to be able to grow out of it, because fundamentally it is an addiction.
Throughout these chats, we've heard the phrase addiction. When it comes to drugs or alcohol, help is at least available in some form or another. In fact, Gary was open and honest enough to admit he sought that help out. But those that have lived and loved violence around football also claim the buzz from it has a drug-like high. Is there a conversation to be had about how these often very young men are dealt with by the system? Both Gary and Graham told us that no one's ever asked them why they did what they did. Others told us that they were harassed and intimidated by the police, which ultimately only made their behaviour worse. Here's PC Paul Elliott again.
I've said this a load of times. You can't really ban your way out of these issues, you know what I mean? You can't ban everyone. You know, you can try to ban everyone, but it doesn't really solve this problem. Do you know what I mean? It doesn't really solve a lot of the behaviour that's happening is minor. Is it sort of antisocial behaviour? You know, it's antisocial, and it can quickly escalate into criminal behaviour. You know, because if a cop goes in to speak to someone to tell them to calm down or to get off his shoulders or to stop hitting the tellies or, you know, to behave in a certain way, and he gets told where to go, there's only going to be one winner in that scenario, isn't there? Do you know what I mean? And I think ultimately, I understand where they're coming from in saying, you know, we have to call it out. And to a degree, we do have to call it out. You know, if we don't agree with the behaviour of certain people, I think it's everyone's responsibility who's involved in the game, you know, to say, listen, this isn't great. What you're going to end up with is reduced allocations, you know, higher prices because the clubs are having to stand the cost of additional policing, an increase in people being banned from going either by the club or by the police, you know, through criminal avenues. And ultimately, it'll lend itself to a very, you know, sterile, dull experience. You know, there's nothing wrong with going to the game and having a laugh, you know what I mean, and, yeah, and having and jumping around and celebrating and having a drink like we used to do.
The extremes all round end up that it lessens the experience for the majority,
for everyone. Yeah, of course,
because
it is, yeah.
You know, you mentioned, I mean, when you said it then, I was thinking, yeah, you know, the Old Firm now, there's no away fans, is there, and things like that. No. You know, some of the things that are proposed by Mark Roberts in his many pieces in the media recently, you know, like sniffer dogs at every match or being searched at every match. You know, it's all just like slowing down. You're getting in the ground. We've already got these weird ticket systems, which have done a good job of that anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
And all of a sudden, it just all feels like heavy and not enjoyable. And surely, you know, none of us want that on either the police or football fans or police who are football fans themselves, like yourself.
You know, I don't want to do myself out of a job, but ultimately we shouldn't be policing football matches, should we? You know, unfortunately we have to because of what goes on at some of the games, not all of the games, but some of the games. And what you'll see is a very, you know, let's be perfectly honest, there's hundreds of thousands of people, if not millions of people, going to a football match every Saturday, and the vast majority of them don't see any issues and yeah, don't get involved in any issues and don't have any bad experience of the police. However, what will start to happen is their experience of going the game will be lessened by the fact that you've got these additional checks, or you've got to get there a bit earlier, or you don't want to get there early. You want to get there and you only want to spend 90 minutes there. You know, as an Evertonian, you probably don't, the 90 minutes in the middle is probably the worst, well, has recently been the worst bit of it. You know, it's a great day out in at the footy. I love football. I absolutely love it. I love the day. I love the experience of it. And for me, being in the police, being the football officer, is like the best job you can do. I love meeting the football fans, you know, and having a crack with them and going the games and seeing the enjoyment they get from the games. What I don't like is seeing people, you know, either in fear or angry or, you know, upset by stuff that happens in and around the football. And that, and unfortunately at the minute, that's starting to creep back in. And it is. I'd be lying if I didn't say, you know, a couple of games, people have got off trains and sort of shook their heads at me and said, you need to get a grip of these. You know, and that's the challenge, is how do we get a grip of it? I'm very much from the sort of train of thought that we have to try and find a solution that doesn't involve courts and punitive measures, because I genuinely don't think it works. You know, I don't. Yeah, you're going to ban someone for 3 or 4 years, but they're going to come back.
Yeah,
we see it all. I see it all the time. I've never seen anyone who's banned who's never come back to football and either continued with the behaviour, or, you know, certainly stayed part of the group and maybe tailored what they do, you know, the behaviour. But it, so from that point of view, I don't think banning people works per se. Now, don't get me wrong, if you've stamped on someone's head, or, you know what I mean, if you've done something totally horrendous, then yeah, of course you should be excluded. That should be part of it. But then it should go hand in hand with some sort of, you know, course or something that gets you back on the right path and addresses that behaviour, why you're like that. Because if you're like that at a football match, what are the chances that you're like that at home? What are the chances that you're like that, you know, in your relationship and stuff? You know, it needs a bigger look at that, really.
We also wanted to get a perspective from someone who works for a football authority. So we got Bob Eastwood, who's the head of security for the EFL.
We do have a problem. We have had a problem, which is why I'm in the position that I am. But we have had a problem with the behaviour of some fans for a long period of time. It's just that since lockdown has ended, some of those problems have increased, you know, quite significantly. We've all seen the issues on social media as well as on television programmes, on the news. And basically, we've had an increase in poor behaviours, and football is coming together to work with clubs and fan groups and fans in order to deal with this quite significant problem before it gets truly out of hand. I've seen it with my own eyes where fans have actually stepped in and tried to get somebody who's behaving badly, has tried to get them to behave. I was told by some fans, I won't mention the clubs, but I was told by some away fans that they apologised to the home stewards for the behaviour of some of their own. That, you know, they were C-bombing, telling them to F off, being really disrespectful. And it's not pleasant, you know, for anybody. These are decent people that go to the club, that many of them support, to actually support the club by working as a steward, you know, and it's not acceptable. But there is something in that which goes to show that fans do actually intervene on some of these issues, and football, and I can include the police in this, and the Sports Ground Safety Authority, we do not have the sole answer to any of this. You know, the answer actually comes from within fans and fan groups. You know, the fans and fan groups properly engaged can provide a real effective, credible ally in relation to football's efforts to tackle some of the fan behaviour that's ruining the experience for a lot of people. There's a lot of things that the EFL does that, unfortunately, it doesn't get to the attention of some fans. You know, there's a lot of things that we already do, but we need to improve on that, as do fans and fan groups. You know, they also have a responsibility to engage with us, and we really are operating an open door here, and we do want to work with people because we need to deal with this. Because my biggest concern is actually if somebody was to lose their life at one of our fixtures, you know, in fact at any fixture at any ground in the country, and some of the behaviours that we've seen. You know, I spent 30 years in the police. I know that some people have actually been killed in similar circumstances. You know, somebody's throwing something. We've had a golf ball thrown. We've had pyrotechnics thrown. We've had bottles thrown. You know, it's only by pure luck that people haven't suffered really serious injuries.
There are people who are involved in this behaviour. You know, do you think the EFL would be prepared, or is it prepared already? Does it do it now? I don't know. Would it commit time or money to working with supporters on those specific issues?
We are doing, yeah. Actually. Yeah. And on the plans for the new season includes a lot more of that. You know, you mentioned drug use there, and this has given me an opportunity to mention my own personal perspective on this. There is a problem with some fans consuming drugs either before or during a fixture, whether that's the English Football League or whether that's the English Premier League. That's not relevant. There is that problem. I've actually spoken to a number of police officers and safety officers about this. And on one occasion, a number of fans were seen taking drugs in the stand and snorting it from the surface of an iPhone. And the last person to actually take some was 15 years of age. Nobody listening to this can ever think that that's acceptable. Mm. And I've also spoken to the police, and the police have told me that a fan's behaviour is more daring, more risk-taking if they have consumed particular types of drugs, you know, and that makes them behave in a more violent way because they don't have those controls, those elements of self-control. And not only is that unpleasant for football's operational staff to deal with or the police to deal with, you've also got to remember that some of these people, some of these fans on a match day that do behave in this way can destroy their life. The person who went on the pitch and assaulted Billy Sharp, who was sent to prison within 48 hours of assaulting him, and he was seriously hurt, was Billy Sharp, and he could have been even more seriously hurt because of the way he hit him and the fact that he wasn't facing the person who attacked him.
Blindside.
Yeah, he caught him on his blind side, exactly. Well, the lad who did that was in a well-paid job, he had a young child, and he had a mortgage to pay, and I'm told his partner wasn't in employment. That's what I was told. So you think of the fact that he's still in prison, and when he comes out of prison, he's got no job, no income, and he's literally going to have to start rebuilding his life because he's also got a young child to think about. You know, these are the sort of outcomes that some fans don't think about, you know, because not every fan who behaves badly is a really bad person. They're caught up in the moment. And if anything can sort of teach somebody how not to behave at a football game, they need to stop and think what the real implications are, because they're absolutely severe, you know, for the rest of their life.
James Carter is the head of clinical programmes and mental health for the NHS in the South East. He's also a Blackpool supporter and worked with Reading Football Club's Community Trust.
Football is such an important factor in our culture that any opportunity to utilise the game, the sport we love, the communities that we exist in, to actually come together and support each other is, you know, potentially massive. I'm minded of an example at Everton, where they have there's a group of lads that called Talk Hub, which is run out by a lad called Jay Deakin, who's brilliant. He himself suffers from OCD, goes home and away, had a torrid time this season, as you'd expect. And he runs walk and talk groups during the weekends and stuff, if there's, you know, if during the off season and during the week. Also does football, like five-a-side type exercises, you know, like sort of five-a-side matches and what have you. And he's also just started boxing as well. He's working with a boxing gym in Liverpool, or just outside Liverpool. And he's got like sort of 7 to 10 lads at any one time coming in, doing an activity, feeling like they're not actually going in for a mental health intervention, which is the core part for men, you know. Never go in on mental health, always go in on something else. So there are loads of examples there. And I'm really impressed with the potential that, you know, things like the community trusts could actually do. I'm really keen on that. Spent some time working as a volunteer trustee at Reading, and that was interesting. But, you know, again, there's so much more to do. When you talk about sort of how football can sort of come around this area, I would say because it means something, and because, you know, the reason that people tend to sort of hang out, and I've been to places like Chesterfield on a cold February Saturday, and, you know, it's felt tense, you know, like walking around the, you know, cobbled streets and the alleyways and what have you, and it feels tense, but then there's that real togetherness element. And it'd be great if we could find a way to try and tap into that in a positive way. I think too often it tends to sort of dip off straight away, you know, like a lot of people just tend to come together, a lot of excitement, a lot of, you know, sort of anxiety and helplessness, you know, that you see, that I reckon there's so much energy there that you could really do something with.
And so months after the podcast idea was first formulated, with over 8 hours of audio in the can, and after some eye-opening conversations on and off the record, back in Liverpool, we reflected on what we had heard.
Okay, so this idea, Amanda, first came around from someone who got in touch with you, a football fan who got in touch with you, who was being led down a certain path, both by his own decisions, but also by the lead of people he was hanging around with at football, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. I got a message. Could I please contact this guy? Because he was getting a load of harassment off the police. So I rang him up, and as I suspected, the police were harassing him for good reason. And we ended up having a 2-hour conversation about lifestyle choices, drugs, addiction, and in a nutshell, he was very in deep in this darker side of football, very unhealthy lifestyle, but he couldn't extract himself from it. And I just thought it was a really interesting topic, hence contacting you to see if we could explore it further.
And you did a thread on Twitter at the time about it, and that led to quite a few people sort of, you know, nodding along in an online way, agreeing with what both you were saying and the experience of him as well, didn't they?
Absolutely, yeah. There was lots of comments on the actual Twitter thread to that effect, and I also got lots of DMs from people saying this was me 15 years ago, 20 years ago, and also lots of people saying if this particular fan wanted to contact these individuals for advice and help and mentoring, they would have been very open to that. So yeah, it definitely touched a nerve.
And you know, since then we've obviously made this happen, spoke to a series of people, been all over the country, some fruitful trips and some less so, but that's not a reflection on the people who have ended up in the podcast. It's more a reflection on, you know, we went to some places, then we went to a non-league match over little reports around something going off around that. That didn't really turn out how we thought it was going to. But I think the rest of it's been really interesting, hasn't it, in terms of lifestyles that people are in and choices that they are making. And also, you know, has it gone as you thought it would do, or is there anything that surprised you along the way?
It's pretty much gone as I thought, as I think we both thought it would. But I just found it really interesting. Lots of common themes through all the individuals that we spoke to effectively were fully aware that they were sacrificing an awful lot in their current lifetime and potentially in their futures to lead this sort of lifestyle. And they were all aware of exactly what they were doing. None of them were oblivious to the risks, but that wasn't enough and isn't enough to sort of pull them away from that unhealthy way of supporting their football clubs.
And there's lots of directions you can go with it, isn't there? And I think, you know, we've been clear in our conversations as we've been doing it that, you know, we might get to the end here and we don't necessarily have answers or solutions or anything like that. It was more to try and document that there is this side to football, that there is another side, a perhaps unhealthy side in many circumstances. Of course, we've heard about addictions. We've heard about people describing their love of violence as an addiction as well. Clearly, there are themes there. There are things to tackle and get stuck into. But as I say, you know, we don't have all the answers. It's more we put this together to say this exists, and maybe football authorities, and maybe police, and maybe, you know, other public bodies, etc., do need to come together and think about the current way they go at it.
No, they absolutely do. And you know, as well, I think what I found interesting, I think people have this perception of what these individuals are like, i.e. they're thick, they don't, or they might have had a shit family life, or they haven't got a job. I think we found the opposite, didn't we, with a lot of the people that we spoke to. You can't categorise these people as sort of brain dead yobs, because they're very clearly not. But as you said, there's a definite gulf in the market, as it were, for, I think, as you said, the police and various stakeholders in football to look beyond this hooligan lifestyle. Because if they don't understand the motivation and what makes these people tick, how can they possibly look towards reducing the problems that are in the game that originate from a lot of these individuals?
But all that said as well, you know, we can't sort of go all the way through and not sort of say, you know, some of it quite clearly crosses the line in society and all the rest of it. Because, you know, I know you, Amanda, of course, have been called an apologist for hooligans in the past.
I have.
By a certain Mr. Mark Roberts. Hi, Mark, if you're listening. But it's not about that, is it? It's more about sort of saying, look, of course, I recognise that, you know, some of this is crossing the line, some of this is illegal, etc., etc. But again, it's talking about it and having an open conversation about it and having an honest conversation without the tabloid side to it, without the all football fans are X, because all football fans aren't X, are they? We're all individuals, we're all different. And, you know, the majority of people, I think, as me and you both have been saying for years and years and years, the majority of people who click through the turnstiles don't want this lifestyle.
No, they don't. Of course they don't. And, you know, the fact that we found it so hard to find people to talk to is absolutely indicative of that. But again, you know, I think various strands of criminality are studied and documented in a very serious way, but football hooligans aren't. And we've absolutely not tried to do that, not least because we're not qualified to do it. But I think we've sort of perhaps shown people that, you know, as I said, what motivates these individuals who, yeah, absolutely do cross the line. And that was one of the things that sort of triggered my interest after the conversation with the initial fan that got in touch. You know, literally walking this line, You know, they go out every Saturday knowing exactly what's going to happen. And, you know, very, very worst case scenario, it could see them seriously injured, it could see them dead, or it could see them lose their liberty. But none of those things are enough to stop this very obviously very strong magnetic pull towards this lifestyle.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, hopefully it's been food for thought for people listening in. Hopefully it's food for thought for the likes of football clubs, police forces, other authorities that, you know, have an influence on this situation. I think it's interesting, Amanda, that, you know, there are, as we all know, different ways to approach this. We've heard people in this podcast say that, you know, they didn't think, for instance, just being thrown in a cell and left to it was particularly influential on the behaviour from there on in. Obviously, Gary talk about that. I mean, you know, in your job, you're seeing this type of stuff all the time, which is one of the reasons we've been able to do it, because, you know, you've been able to find these people, speak to these people, suggest that they spoke to us on a podcast, and that's one of the reasons we've been able to make it happen. What are there any things you would like to see yourself in terms of, and again, you know, I'm not saying that you should have all the answers or anything like that, but just more other things you would like to see introduced? What could they be? What could football clubs, police, all of the other authorities involved, what could they be looking at around all this?
Well, we asked virtually everyone, didn't we? You know, if somebody had said to you a few years ago, look, you're going down the wrong path here, how can we help you? They virtually all said we would not have listened to anybody that tried to tell us. So there's that barrier that needs to be overcome.
Yeah.
But I think football traditionally has always been about the punitive. It's been about the arrests and it's been about the football banning orders. And absolutely some people, including some of those that we spoke to, were arrested, rightly so, did get football banning orders, rightly so. But, you know, I will often make the comparison between the huge safety net that's in place for, you know, like young people who are in street gangs, who carry knives. You know, they get arrested, they get taken into a police station, and there's all sorts of people that will go in and help them and try and move them away from that lifestyle. So, you know, I'm absolutely not making a direct comparison between street gangs and football gangs, but why should, you know, it's not a competition, it shouldn't be an either or, but why don't these younger men in this world of football violence get these same opportunities to help deter them from the lifestyle that they are in?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, big thanks to you, Amanda, first and foremost, because without you, none of this would have happened. You've been excellent at both organising me and this. Big thank you as well to all the people who've contributed, all the people we've interviewed, all the people who've given up their time to do this. Hope you've enjoyed it. It's been something a little bit different. It's been an Anfield Rap special. Let us know what you think.
For honest information about drugs and pointers to support near you, call Frank on 0300 123 6600, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You can also text the question to Frank on 82111. That's 82111. For more information, go to talktofrank.com. For wider support regarding mental health and a detailed list of specialist support around drugs, alcohol, gambling and more, visit mind.org.uk and click the information and support tab. Whatever you're going through, at any time, you can call Samaritans free from any phone on 116 123.
Sports Social Podcast Network.